This machine kills secrets. How WikiLeakers, cypherpunks, and hacktivists aim to free the world's information. By Andy Greenberg. Narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Copyright 2012 by Andy Greenberg. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Dutton, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Prologue. The Mega Leak. On a rainy November day in a garden flat in London, Julian Assange is giving me a lecture on the economics of leaking. To put it simply, in order for there to be a market, there has to be information. A perfect market requires perfect information, he says, settling his 6-foot-2-inch body, clothed in a sleek navy suit, into the couch, a coffee mug in hand. His voice is a hoarse, Aussie-tinged baritone. As a teenage hacker in Melbourne, its pitch helped him impersonate IT staff to trick companies' employees into revealing their passwords over the phone. And today, it's deeper still after a recent bout of flu. His once shaggy white hair, recently dyed brown, has been cropped to a sandy leopard print of blonde and tan. He said he colors it when he's being tracked. There's the famous lemon example in the used car market. It's hard for buyers to tell lemons from good cars, and sellers can't get a good price, even when they have a good car, he says in a professorial tone. We identify the lemons. Assange today has a particular lemon in mind. He's just told me that WikiLeaks plans to release tens of thousands of internal emails from a major American bank in early 2011, just a few months away from our meeting. He won't say which bank or exactly what the emails will reveal, but he promises they will expose corporate malfeasance on a massive scale, enough to take down a bank or two. You could call it the ecosystem of corruption, he says. But it's also all the regular decision-making that turns a blind eye to and supports unethical practices. The oversight that's not done, the priorities of executives, how they think they're fulfilling their own self-interest. This is Assange at the height of his power. When I report his words later that month in Forbes magazine, speculation that WikiLeaks' target would be Bank of America shaves off $3.5 billion from the company's stock market value in a matter of hours. The 39-year-old WikiLeaks founder had gotten accustomed to the feeling of his thumb on the eject button for the world's institutional information. In the last 4 months, his group had already spilled 76,000 secret documents from the Afghan war and another 391,000 from the war in Iraq. Entire shadow histories of the two wars, the largest public classified data breaches of all time. These big package releases. There should be a cute name for them, he says with a stern look. Megaleaks? I offer tentatively. Megaleaks. That's good, he says. These megaleaks, they're an important phenomenon, and they're only going to increase. A few hours later, after I've turned my recorder off, Assange has donned his gray parka, and he and his assistant are packing up to leave. That's when he lets slip that WikiLeaks is planning another megaleak in the near future, speaking about it as if it were an embarrassing technicality he mentions only out of necessity. A big one? I ask, sweating a little. He responds that it's 7 times the size of the Iraq War document dump. Does it affect the private sector or a government? I try to subdue the panicked feeling that after 3 hours of talking to a man who dispenses secrets to reporters like Christmas gifts, I'm somehow only now getting the real story. Both, he says. Which industries? I ask, thinking of my editor's interests at the business magazine I work for. That's when Assange's professional dispassion seems to crack, and he allows an unrestrained, full schoolboy grin to spread across his face, complete with his usually hidden overbite. All of them, he says. A minute later, he's out the door and disappeared down the rain-shined sidewalks of London. Cablegate changed the world. 3 weeks after my meeting with Assange, 251,000 once secret State Department cables began flowing out of WikiLeaks and would continue for the next year. The documents had too many connections to too many world affairs to draw straight lines between cause and effect. But when a sidewalk vendor named Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in front of the governor's office in the Tunisian town of Sidi Bouzid, the country's citizens responded by taking to the streets to overthrow their government. Many of them cited WikiLeaks' revelations about the U.S. State Department's disdain for Tunisian President Ben Ali as giving them the courage to oppose their dictator of the prior 2.5 decades. If they stood up to him, it was now clear America wasn't coming to his aid. As populist anger spread to Egypt, Libya, Syria, and elsewhere, Muammar Gaddafi warned Libyans in a televised speech not to read WikiLeaks, which publishes information written by lying ambassadors in order to create chaos. 9 months later, that revolutionary chaos had overwhelmed his military, ousted him from power, and killed him. When President Obama announced that all American troops would be leaving Iraq by the end of 2011, CNN reported that WikiLeaks had cratered negotiations that might have kept them there longer. U.S. generals had asked for guarantees of legal protection for any remaining soldiers in the country. But thanks to leaked cables that revealed a massacre of Iraqi civilians and a subsequent cover-up, the Iraqi government had refused and sent the American forces on their way. But even as Assange's ultra-scoop percolated around the globe, the bank leak he had foretold to me failed to appear. For the next year, the Australian carefully dodged all questions about the non-leak, offering veiled excuses and eventually seeming to pin the blame on a rogue staffer who WikiLeaks would claim deleted the files. Assange's brash vows to take down a bank or two only contributed to the bank's vicious retaliation against WikiLeaks. Bank of America joined an informal coalition of payment firms including Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Western Union, and others who refused to process donations to the world's most controversial website, choking it to the point of paralysis. Today, WikiLeaks is on life support. Assange faces questioning for alleged sex crimes in Sweden, and more American legal foes waiting in the wings. Revelations by the prosecutors of WikiLeaks' alleged source, Bradley Manning, suggest Assange may have actively coached the young army private, potential grounds for his own indictment. His organization's work has stalled as it struggles to raise cash. Some of its most ardent supporters have become its most bitter critics, and its releases have dropped sharply in frequency and impact. Assange seems more interested in hosting a TV talk show on the Russian government-funded network RT than in rebuilding his organization. And WikiLeaks watchers from Evgeny Morozov to Richard Stallman argue that the group's fate holds dark lessons. With WikiLeaks, they say, the web turned out to be less the free anarchic realm we once imagined than a restrictive platform tightly controlled by corporations and governments. But it would be a mistake to focus only on how WikiLeaks has been contained, muzzled, punished, and sabotaged, while ignoring a larger lesson. How the group has inspired an entire generation of political hackers and digital whistleblowers. That story didn't begin or end with Julian Assange, or even with his institution-eviscerating group. Instead, it tracks the ideals, the means, and the movement that WikiLeaks represents, extending from its predecessors decades earlier to the ideological descendants it has radically mobilized. Since my meeting with Assange that rainy day in London, that thread has taken me from one edge of the Western world to the other, as I sought out the history and future of an idea: digital, untraceable, anonymous leaking. And the line of thought I followed remains stronger in many ways than ever before. The activists and fellow travelers I've met have no illusions about WikiLeaks and Assange's weaknesses and failures. but they share the same spirit that drove Assange, to build a better secret-spilling machine than the last one. This Machine Kills Secrets is a book about the forces that coalesced to make WikiLeaks happen. And it's also about how those forces are working to make it happen again. The insider's drive to expose institutional secrets, to conscientiously blow the whistle, or vindictively dump a superior's dirty laundry, has always existed. But the technology that enables the spillers of secrets has been accelerating its evolution since the invention of computing. With the dawn of the Internet, the apparatus of disclosure entered a Cambrian explosion, replicating its effective features, excising its failed components, and honing its methods faster than ever before. The state of the world's information favors the leaker now more than ever. In 2002, the amount of digitally recorded data in the world finally matched the amount of analog recorded information, according to a study by the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Just 5 years later, in 2007, the most recent year the study included, digital information already accounted for 94% of the world's recorded information. And all of that information is liquid, infinitely reproducible, frictionlessly mobile, fundamentally leakable. Just what fraction of that vast digital swamp remains secret is tough to gauge. But Harvard science historian Peter Galison, taking printed files as a proxy, estimates that there are 5 times as many pages being added to the world's classified libraries as to its unclassified ones. Despite Barack Obama's promises of a more transparent government, 76.7 million documents were classified in 2010. Compared with 8.6 million in 2001 and 23.4 million in 2008, the first and last years of George W. Bush's administration. The numbers of people who have access to that material are just as unfathomable. 4 million Americans have some form of clearance to read classified information. Of those, about 1.2 million have top secret clearance. But the abundance of widely shared secrets is hardly the only factor pushing the leaking movement forward. Anonymous whistleblowing remains a game of skirting surveillance, and WikiLeaks' key advancement in the science of spilling information has been in separating the leaker from the leaked information. Cutting the data trail to a leak's source was the crucial trick that emboldened ever greater disclosures from whistleblowers leading up to the Cablegate blowout. That's why the story of leaked secrets, from the days of Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, to the growing brood of sites hoping to reproduce WikiLeaks' work, has not been driven merely by digital disclosure, but by digital anonymity. And true digital anonymity requires cryptography. The craft of cryptographic leaking that WikiLeaks brought to light seems like a paradox. A movement focused on divulging secrets depends on a technology invented to keep them. But anonymity technologies represent a special kind of encryption. They reveal data itself, while hiding certain metadata about the data. Specifically, anonymity tools hide that one metadatum that counts most, the IP address that can be linked immediately to a user's location and device. Protecting that one fact is a harder trick than it sounds. In the end, strong anonymity tools have taken more than a decade longer than mere strong encryption to make their way into the hands of the average internet user. But that strong anonymity, as it slowly matured over the course of 2 decades, was the lever WikiLeaks used to upend the world. Today, a schizoid hive mind of internet pundits and social media theorists claims simultaneously that everyone knows no anonymity exists on the internet. These days, the web unmasks everyone, states a New York Times headline from 2011, and that everyone knows no identity exists on the internet, that no one knows you're a dog, as the New Yorker cartoon caption reads. Half of security gurus preach about the internet's invasion of privacy, while the other half bemoan the internet's lack of authentication, which they say makes the task of identifying bad actors, what they call the attribution problem, nearly impossible. Forget these conflicting parallel realities. The internet is neither fundamentally private nor fundamentally public, anonymous or onimous. Those who behave a certain way online and use certain services will have no privacy, while those who behave another way and use other services can be very, very hard to identify. Harder to identify now in many ways than ever in communications history. The public and private paths on the internet have been diverging. Today, users have the option to use a service like Facebook, which is designed to learn your real name and attach it to all your actions, preferences, locations, and even thoughts. Or they can use a service like WikiLeaks' now-defunct submission system, which was designed to learn absolutely nothing about them. In fact, to provably demonstrate to users by using modern anonymity software like Tor that it can't learn anything about them. All of which is to say that WikiLeaks wasn't a one-off fluke, a brilliant hacker's lucky break, or, as digital pundit Clay Shirky has characterized the press's image of WikiLeaks, a series of unfortunate events. It was the inevitable outcome of the changing nature of information and advancements in cryptographic anonymity, catalyzed to an explosion by Assange's actions. The first two parts of this book will tell the story of how leaking has been transformed over the last 40 years by generations of cryptographers and revolutionary activists of all stripes. The third part tours the post-WikiLeaks world, following the same movement of radical hacktivists as they seek to systematize, replicate, and evolve the craft of disclosure. As I traveled from San Francisco to Iceland to Berlin to Bulgaria to report this story, I was searching not so much for WikiLeaks' methods, its influences, or its sequels, as I was trying to write the story of an ideal that drove this hidden movement. It was on a street in my own neighborhood in Gowanus, Brooklyn, that I saw a busker sitting on a curb, strumming a guitar with the same words scrawled across it that once were written across the one Woody Guthrie played: "This machine kills fascists." That sentence, to me, brought to mind the ideological arrow I see from Ellsberg to Assange and beyond. A revolutionary protest movement bent not on stealing information, but on building a tool that inexorably coaxes it out, a technology that slips inside of institutions and levels their defenses against the free flow of data, like a Trojan horse of cryptographic software and silicon. But the machine that kills secrets isn't merely WikiLeaks, or the photocopier that duplicated the Pentagon Papers, or the anonymity network Tor, or even the internet. It's a living idea, one that continues to evolve in the minds of all those who aim to obliterate the world's institutional secrecy.